All right. Good morning to those of you just joining us. I'd like to call the CHESLA board meeting to order. As is our custom, I need to read some guidelines that go with electronic meetings. So please bear with me.
I'm supposed to be there at...
In accordance with state law regarding public meetings held via electronic equipment, this meeting will be recorded, and the recording will be posted on the authority's website within 7 days of the meeting. Because there's no public comment on today's agenda, members of the public will not be permitted to speak during the meeting, with the exception of the authority's consultants and professionals. And in accordance with the governor's executive order regarding public meetings held via electronic equipment, board members and consultants and professionals are asked to state their name and title before speaking. Votes will be taken by roll call unless the vote is unanimous. And in the event the meeting is interrupted due to technical difficulties, members and staff will receive an email or text message advising whether, number one, the meeting is adjourned or canceled, or number two, the time the meeting will resume. So with that taken care of, I'd like to do a roll call for attendees on the call. Starting with board members, my name is Peter Lisi. Obviously, I'm present. Marty Budd. Marty?
At the unmute. I'm here. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Andrew Foster.
Present.
Daryl Hill.
Present.
Thank you. Julie Savino.
Present.
Julie?
Present.
Thank you. Jeanette Weldon?
Present.
And Laura Baker as the designee for Kelly Marie Valliere's.
Present.
Thank you. Let's move over to CHESLA staff. Rebecca Ablett?
Here.
Denise Aguilera?
Here.
Kevin Berry? Dan Junji?
Present.
Thank you. Josh Herlock?
Here.
Thank you. Carly Levin?
Present.
Joanne Makowitz?
Present.
Cynthia Peoples?
I'm present.
Kara Stewart?
Present.
Yesenia Torres Rivera?
Present.
Thank you. And Shannon Reynolds, we're not expecting, but is Shannon on the call?
Shannon won't be here. She's out today.
Okay. And then consultants, vendors, when I call your company's name, if you could please indicate you are present. Do we have anyone from Bank of America?
Yes, Joe Santora.
Thank you. Hilltop Securities?
Yes, this is Tim Webb. I'm the only one from Hilltop on the phone.
Thank you, Tim. Pullman and Conley.
Judith Blank and Sandy Dawson.
Thank you. RBC Capital Markets.
Yes, you have Jeff Wagner, Barry Wolf, Taylor Walsh, Akshay Podol, and...
Was there one more?
Sorry, could you hear me?
Could you run through those names again, please?
No problem. Jeff Wagner, Gary Wolf, Brian Karras, Tyler Walsh, and Rockship Podol.
Okay. Thank you. All right. U.S. Bank.
Yes, Bill Kutkowski is on.
Thank you. CHESLA Advisory Committee. Do we have Rich Bishop? Wilson Luna? Okay, neither. And is Dr. Carnival on from Georgetown?
I think so.
All right, thank you. Anyone on the call, anyone participating whose name I didn't call? All right. The roll call is done. Let's move into the agenda, please. First item are the minutes from May 12th, I'm hoping people have taken a look at them. Is there a motion to accept the minutes from May 12th as presented?
This is Andrew, so moved.
Thank you, Andrew. Is there a second?
This is Julie Savino, I'll second.
Thank you. The motion's been made and seconded to accept the minutes. I'll open up to discussion. Are there any edits or comments, changes, any corrections to the minutes from May 12th? Hearing none, all those in favor of accepting the minutes as proposed, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Is there anyone opposed? Are there any abstentions? Thank you. Motion carries unanimously. Next item is our speaker. I believe, Jeanette, you will introduce him.
Yes. So we're joined this morning by Dr. Anthony Carnevale, who currently serves as research professor and director of the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce, a position he's held since the center was created in 2008. And between 1996 and 2006, Dr. Carnevale served as vice president for public leadership at the Educational Testing Service, where he was also appointed by President George Bush to serve on the White House Commission on Technology and Adult Education. Dr. Carnevale has some vast experience. He also was the founder and president of the Institute for Workplace Learning between 1983 and 1993. And that institute worked with private companies to develop high performance work systems and develop more effective work and training systems. He's also served as a senior staff member in both houses of the US Congress. So Dr. Carnevale will be providing some commentary on post-secondary education programs. So I'm turning it over to, can you hear me? Can you hear me, Tony?
Yes. Can you see me?
No, we can't, unfortunately. But
Oh, wait a minute. Wait a minute. I'm not doing something obvious here. Can you see me now?
Yes.
Okay. Sorry about that. Thanks, Jeanette. I just want to run quickly through what I think will be context for all of you figuring out where we are at the moment in terms of our labor force and its skill profile and skill requirements on the job. I think the first fact that comes to mind, at least for me, in discussing that is that since 1983, after the 80-81 recession, we began a pretty dramatic shift in the United States, a lot of which caught a lot of people off guard and a lot of people fell behind. In the 70s, two-thirds of all the jobs required no more than a high school diploma, and truthfully, if you look closely, didn't even require a high school diploma. But nowadays, more than two-thirds of jobs require at least some post-secondary education or training. And the other huge shift is that workers with post-secondary education and or training now hold a larger share of at least what my center and some other people call good jobs. That is jobs that pay at least $45,000 at about age 40. Again, that's a minimum of 45. The actual number is much higher when you look at who those people are. In 1980, almost 30% of good jobs, corrected for the value of money, went to workers with a high school diploma or less. Now, 80% of those good jobs go to workers with at least some post-secondary education. The second set of facts is that the growth in the value of education and training had two powerful and somewhat contradictory economic aspects. First, on average, higher levels of post-secondary attainment still means more money. The old-time religion is still true. The more you get, the more you make, on average. The marquee fact here that college presidents love to talk about is that the median economic value added of a BA doubled over the value of high school degrees after 1983. And that's still true. It flattened out about 1995, and most of the dramatic increases now go to graduate degrees, especially for men. But what has changed even more, the piece that confuses the conversation constantly, is that after 1983, there was an increasing variation in earnings by program or field of study. That is, if our economic and education system melded more and more as a result of economic relationships between programs and the value of jobs, earnings, and employment. So this is why when you look at the data now, about 16% of high school graduates have good jobs, 23% of workers with some college, which is to say less than a bachelor's degree, but more than a high school degree, mostly certificates and two-year degrees. You can also throw certification, industry-based certifications into that pot. About 28% of people with associate's degrees have good jobs. So there is one of the most striking things that has happened is that the relationship between education, training, and the economy is now driven by the relationship between field of study or college major, whatever you want to call it, employment and earnings. So that, yes, it is true that if you get a four-year degree, you're more likely to get a good job, but not necessarily so. You can still get a good job with a two-year degree. A certificate or certification, and the not so new but largely unrecognized player in the game, the industry-based certification, pretty much comes with a good job. Certifications are different than certificates, very important difference. Certifications are industry-driven, license-driven, regulatory-driven. That is, you can't work in a nuclear plant if you don't have a safety certification. So there are about 40 million of those in the American workforce. One thing to keep in mind with those, as distinct from community college certificates, is that certifications require that you pass an exam. Usually, in the majority of cases, you have to pass an exam that forces you to keep up or catch up with changes in the certification requirements. So you take the test, especially in healthcare, computers, and regulatory certifications, you have to update them constantly. And about 70% of people who have certifications are people who already have a two-year or four-year degree. So that speaks to the fact that there is a mix now of education degrees, let's call education degrees, and training. That is, oftentimes it requires both, especially over the lifetime of a career. The more troubling set of facts that goes along with all this change is that all this is true for advantaged students. That is, they've kind of made the grade since the 80s, especially white students. But that's not the case for minorities, working class Americans, and there are significant differences in earnings by program for women. That is, women tend to be concentrated in programs where earnings are low ultimately in the labor market. Even when they have this is true for minorities as well. When you have the same degree, same institution, same, in the end, the earnings for minorities and women are lower. So for me, the single fact that I use to make this point, which I think covers the landscape from pre-K to actually age 30 or so, is that when we look at the test scores and IQ tests for children in kindergarten, and we follow them all the way through age 28 to 32, if you come from a family in the top quartile, top 25% of family income, but you have test scores in the bottom half of the test score distribution, you still have a 70% chance of ending up in a good job by age 30. A good job, again, being 45K by age 40. However, if you're a young person, a child, from a low-income family, and by that I mean the bottom 25% of the family income distribution, and you have scores in the top half of the test score distribution, that is, you're a smart disadvantaged kid, you only have a 31% chance of graduating from college and getting a good job by your late 20s. So the enormous increase in the value of education and training in the labor force has increased in the American case our traditional inequality by race, class, and gender. I mean, that in the middle 90s, we started to see that pattern had moved to a point where it had an intergenerational effect. That is, the education system in conjunction with the economy is passing on the value of privilege from one generation to the other, which is a big problem. I think it's good news that human skill has enormous value and increasing value, as does education, as does training, and so on. But it has conformed to the underlying inequality and increased the underlying inequality in the American system. The other thing that's of import here, I think, in general, is that back in the 70s, when you came into the labor market, which most people do, some at 18, some at age 22, 23, 24, even 25. But in the 70s, by the time you were 25 years old, you had met the standard for what most economists think is the transition from youth dependency to adult independence. And the simple metric there is that you were able to achieve the median earnings for your gender, male and female. Of course, the median earnings, a difference between those two, but that was the standard back in the day, still is pretty much now. So what has changed since the good old days is that standard, the time it takes to get there, so to speak, has increased. It used to be you made it at 25. Now at the median, young people make it at age 32. Now that varies, of course, by education level and so on and so forth, but it just takes longer. And the other thing that's happened is that, just to quickly review the policy shift, that is in 83 with the nation at risk, we decided to get rid of vocational education in the K-12 system, both because it didn't work, and secondly, because the civil rights movement, the women's movement, and a variety of the disability movement, the system that we'd created after World War II, beginning in 46, the comprehensive high school, which was a tracking system, that as we came out of the war, we were suddenly the number one global power, notwithstanding the Russians. I guess we're at that again. There was a very strong feeling among American elites that we were now a superpower and that we need smarter people to run this thing. And so we built a high school system called the Comprehensive High School. It was comprehensive because it had something for everybody, was kind of the thinking. In the end, What that meant was that we sent about 5 to 8% of the high school kids to college. The rest of the kids got a very watered down academic curriculum. There was voc ed, which was mostly male. And there was also a female track, but it was mostly the watered down academic system that they were in. And they also got home economics and typing. We're talking about a fundamental shift. We took job-related learning, training, vocational education, whatever you want to call it. We took it out of the K-12 system, ran it out of town on a rail. It came back in much better shape in some ways, but was much less significant. And that is, career and technical education is the new version of voc-ed, and it isn't job training, is the way to think of it. Career and technical education is really a strategy to teach people in an applied fashion, familiarize people with labor markets, remembering that after 83, we disconnected the K-12 system from labor markets altogether. So there's more and more nowadays, more and more value placed on work-based learning, WBL. It has its own acronym now in the academic literature. And that is at a premium. One of the things that stops people from being independent by age 32 is they can't get solid work experience. They can't get high quality work experience. The other piece of this is, now that we've got an education system that really is our workforce development system, we have no counseling system that makes the connections between education and jobs in the United States. It just doesn't exist. We do have the data, by the way. It's taken about 15 years, but we now know for every post-secondary institution in America, we now know what the employment and earnings effects are by program, not just by institution. We live in a world now where the institutions matter less and less, and the programs matter more and more. Those are becoming the dominant driver of differences in earnings. So we're living in a different world now. It's taken a while to get here. We do know the answer that we should be delivering to students, but we're not doing it. The Congress, for example, very easily continues to pass legislation to build the information system. The College Scorecard is probably the most well-known instrument that's been created, but there's a lot of reluctance to give the information to anybody. That is, all this information sits on government websites, out of sight and out of mind. People just don't use them. The obvious next step is to find a way to get them used. It's too expensive, and the obvious thing to do, in my mind, is that the Congress should mandate that institutions give this information for each of their programs. There aren't enough votes for that. So another set of facts which I think have changed the world we're working in and educating in is demography. It's one of the other sure things in data. Demographers have the luxury of always being right because the data is so strong. Once somebody's born, you can predict a lot about what's going to happen to them. So one of the things that's happening in demography that matters a lot now and going forward is demography has divided us into two peoples. There are people in families where there are two bachelor's degree at the head of the household. And when you have two bachelor's degrees at the head of the household, you have the earnings, the income that goes with that, which is to say you're essentially a high earning family. Those students more and more go to selective colleges. They are whiter and they are more affluent. That's their essential characteristic. And they've been moving there since the mid 80s, especially to the bachelor's degree and graduate degrees. Minorities and less advantaged working class white kids have basically been left behind. So I think The demography says, and it has part of the demography is that New England has stopped growing, as have the mid-Atlantic states, and that their youth populations are in decline, as the youth population is in general in America, and that so more and more in the country, there's this divide between people who get post-secondary, especially four-year degrees, graduate degrees, and people who don't. And the divide works as you'd expect it to in the American demographic plane. And there is growth. There's no growth in New England or the mid-Atlantic states. All the growth is south and west. And more of that growth comes from families who are working class, minority, or in some other way less advantaged. And they come from families with much less education at the top of the household. Those families are loan averse. They don't tend to make it through college. They tend to drop out. They're concentrated in the two-year system. And the four-year system gets more and more elite. Yeah, that'll even be more true when we take down race-based affirmative action. Which is easy for the court to do. It's very popular. Even Latinos and African Americans are opposed in the majority to race-based affirmative action. So we're headed for a situation where, in the end, all of this throws, in my mind, while the capstone in the system is the higher education system with the post-secondary education and training system, I think the issue is going back to K-12 again. That is, it really is the extent to which we can prepare people for college and make it affordable that really matters. A couple things that I think you need to know. One is there's some temporary good news that's coming for high school graduates, largely because of the infrastructure bill. It's going to create a lot of high school jobs, but those jobs will go away in 7 or 8 years. I think that's an important point because every state, all the politicians are lined up to cut the ribbons. The reporters there are going to say, do you really need a BA anymore? And they're all going to say no. So I think we're headed for a situation where we're going to have 6 or 7 years of good news for high school graduates. But after that, we're either going to get a new infrastructure bill or we're going to have another dislocation problem.
So, Tony, in the interest of time, I think I wanted to wrap up and see if maybe we can have one question if there's a question. But thank you very much for your commentary.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Are there any questions?
Questions? Okay.
No. Okay. Thank you very much. It was very thought-provoking.
Thank you.
You're quite welcome. Have a good weekend.
You too. Thank
you. Okay. Jeanette, thank you very much for arranging that. Next item is our sales report on the 2022 series bond. Tim, I'm assuming you're on the line. You gonna walk us through that? Tim, are you on mute?
Okay.
Hello, can you hear me?
We can hear you now.
Okay, I don't know what happened. My phone, somehow or another, the phone disconnected. Included in the package, there should be a letter. There's some comparable results, and then there are a number of pages of cash flows. The cash flows begin on page 18 of the packet and go through page 166. There's a lot of information contained within those cash flows. I think the most important thing to note here is that we were successful in being able to price bonds on the 19th of May in a very difficult market. We were able to sell both the Series B bonds, $13,175,000, and then also the Series C bonds, which were the taxable bonds, used to set up an escrow and defease all of the 19 trust. The old 1990 trust. I have prepared a PowerPoint. Jeanette, is that PowerPoint ready to go up?
Yes, it's being displayed.
I'm sorry?
Yes, the PowerPoint is being displayed.
Oh, it is. I can't see it. Okay. So on the in the PowerPoint, if we could go past the starting page, the title page, go to the second page. I think this is this just outlines the bonds. It shows the $13,175, and then the second set of bonds, the Series C, is the $62,375. On page three, though, I think is what's important here. So the Series B bonds were issued to provide funding for Chesla's in-school loan program. Of the $13,175,000, we obviously paid some cost of issuance. We deposited some money to the SCARF, and that leaves approximately $11.6 million of loanable proceeds for the 22-23 in-school loan lending season. Of importance here is what loan rate Chesla has decided to utilize. We're going with a 5.49. It's higher than what it has been in the past. But I think it's important to take a look down at the bottom of this page where it shows the in-school plus rate loan rate versus the plus loan. So this year we'll have a spread differential between the plus and the in-school rate for Chesla of 205 basis points versus 169 last year. In 2021, we had a very tight year at 45 basis points, and in the year before, 193. So there is a good bit of daylight between your primary competitor, the plus rate, and what Chesla will be able to offer. If we go on to the next page, I think you've seen this before. This was the reason for the restructuring or the defeasance of the 1990 trust. Important here is that we have taken out all of the 1990 bonds. They have been defeased. It eliminates that trust completely and all the associated expenses therewith, and releases $5 million to Chesla that will be used to originate refi CT loans. The next page just lists the bonds that are being defeased. Again, I think you've seen that before. On the following page is the structure of the Series B bonds. We have serial maturities 24 to 28, and then a super sinker in 38. Those 24 through 28 bonds are non-callable bonds. The 38 bonds we view as super sinkers, so as excess revenues are coming in, they'll be utilized to take out those bonds. The Series C bonds are structured similarly, 20 through 28, and then a super sinker in 34. These are taxable bonds. So the final page here just is the cash flow assumptions. This is what was used to take a look at this transaction. Included in the board packet is a series of cash flows that is a management case with various assumptions. And then we also ran a stress case that stresses defaults and the prepayment scenarios. Those cash flows were sent over to Treasury for their review. One of the questions or one of the things that we discussed in prior board meetings is what was the cost or I guess you would say the cost associated with doing the refunding. So the way that we looked at this was to look at the status quo, which would be to leave the 1990 bonds outstanding until they are callable, and compare the results of the 1990 bonds on a status quo and then the 2019 bonds on a status quo, including the 2022 issuance of the $13,175,000. look at the receipts off of those two sets of cash flows and compare it to the receipts off the cash flows from this combined new money refunding. And when we look at that on a PV basis, on this page down at the bottom, you'll see status quo one versus the 22 Series BC issue with the footnotes below. We see that the PV disk savings associated with this transaction was roughly $622,000. It was a difficult sale in a difficult market, but I think the underwriters performed very well. We got very attractive rates and happy to have this transaction closed and have $5 million into the bank for Chesla to be able to issue refi CT loans. I think the letter covers everything with regard to the sale, but I'm happy to answer any questions to the extent that there are.
Any questions for Tim?
Yes. The cash flows take into account the slowdown in originations of in student loans.
Yes, they do, Marty. What the cash flows are, how the cash flows are run as a last day origination. So instead of utilizing the origination schedule that Josh anticipates loans being originated at, we assume that that no loans are originated until the last possible date. So yes.
So you assume that we won't use any of the proceeds meant for loans to redeem bonds, that by the end of the last date, you'll have everything originated.
Essentially, you're originating all of those loans on that last day. That's correct.
Right. Josh, do you think you will be able? Isn't there a date in next year that we have to use excess to redeem bonds? Maybe Judith can remember the date. I thought it was in 2023.
Yeah, Judith probably remembers the day. I mean, we sized this so that we're projecting 18.1 million in disbursements, which is our fiscal 21 levels. As you know, this year we're going to be probably in the 16 and change range. But even if we don't reach the fiscal 21 levels, we typically have a few million dollars from the prior year so that we don't have to shut the application off while we, move towards closing on the new bond deal.
The other thing I would point out, Marty, is that the last day origination or the date is 11/15/23. The cash flows were run actually where the last day of April. Of 24. And the reason being the way the indenture is structured, we can extend that period to April of 24 without having to do a series of cash flows. But for this purpose, we ran it out to April. But what I wanted to point out is that if in fact we are having trouble originating loans, this effectively gives us two lending seasons to get all of that $18 million out. So you would have the lending season for 22-23, and then you would also have the lending season for 23-24 to originate those loans. And if you were having trouble and you were not going to, you didn't believe you would be able to originate a huge volume, you wouldn't issue next year. But you would have the ability to use these monies for two full seasons.
Under the indenture, what do you do in order to extend the origination date to 2024? You just make an election of some kind?
Yes. Yeah, Marty, at April 2024, if you choose to continue originating loans, you need to make sure the cash flows still work with those with a projected continuation. And then the authority takes that action to approve continuation. Otherwise, you have the option of calling bonds.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much.
Any other questions for Tim? Anyone? Tim, this is Peter Lisi. At the outset of your presentation, and then almost at the very end, both times you made reference to it was a difficult sale in a difficult market. I guess my question is, was it anything unique or specific to our offering, or was it really the overall market that you referred to? I'm just kind of curious because you mentioned it twice being difficult.
No, it was not with regard to Chesla. It was the market on the whole. Okay. The volatility was the primary problem. First of all, there were significant amounts of monies leaving mutual funds. There were no inflows. In fact, there were outflows out of the funds for the last approximately 5 months. We were having wild swings in both MMD, which is the index that people use for setting the tax exempt, and then also with the Treasury. You would have movements of anywhere from 10 to 15 basis points on a daily basis, both up and down. Initially, we were looking to sell the bonds a little bit later in the month of May, but given the volatility in the market, and we did not want to compete with the state's big GO issuance that was coming the week of the 25th, we ended up pushing the deal forward because we just did not know where interest rates were going to be. The transaction with regard to the C transaction, 20C, had a lot to do with interest rates, whether or not the transaction would be feasible. So we pushed the deal up because at the time transaction would work given where markets were. It was just a very difficult time. We've not been in this situation, at least since I've been with Chesla, where the markets have fluctuated so much. You know, if that does not answer it, perhaps Jeff could, you know, step in and provide a little bit of additional color if you would like so, Peter.
No, I think that's, no, you covered it. You answered my question. Thank you. So I guess just one other thing, either Tim, Jeanette, or Kara, I found the presentation very interesting. There's some good summary information from my vantage point. So can someone send that out to the board? I don't know if that comes from you, Tim, or Kara, or Jeanette, but I'd love to have a hard copy of that presentation.
Yes, we can. Kara can send that out to the board.
Great. Thank you.
I had one more question. It was raised by his answer to your question, Peter. Marty Budd here. Can you tell me what MMD stands for and what's about you? In the documents, you refer to it often.
Yeah, market data. It is an index that is put together that basically provides where bonds were pricing for AAA securities, tax-exempt securities, from very short maturities all the way out to 30-year.
What do you know what MMD stands for?
Municipal market data.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tim. Any other questions for Tim? Anyone? Okay, Tim, thank you again. As usual, very thorough and very informative. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you. And you know, one of the things that we don't ever discuss is that Jeanette and Josh have daily jobs that they work on to make sure that the loans are going out the door. And when we work on these transactions, it puts a lot of additional work into their laps because they're not focused daily on these types of transactions. So appreciate Josh and Jeanette's work on this transaction.
And I just like to mention, we certainly very much appreciated the work of the financing team in the market conditions that we had to deal with. So that's the RBC team, Tim Webb from Hilltop, and also Pullman and Conley as bond counsel.
Okay. Well, thank you all. Great team effort. Okay, next agenda item, the scholarship memo. Josh, I think you and Yesenia are going to walk us through that for board approval.
Yeah, thanks, Peter. So we'll start on page 167 of the board package. I'll start with the executive summary. So if the board recalls at the January meeting, an allocation of $470,000 was approved for scholarships, for undergraduate degree scholarships. As of June 7th, our scholarship account had about $38,000 in excess, stemming from unused proceeds and student enrollment changes throughout the years, and also earned interest. So at the conclusion of this memo, management is seeking board approval to award 171 scholarships totaling $489,000. So now Yesenia will go through the key stats and the program structure.
I'm happy to make that resolution to increase the amount out for scholarships now.
Okay. Marty's made a motion. Someone like to second it?
This is Andrew Foster. I'll second.
All right. Well, the motion's been made and seconded. Any discussion? Yesenia, is there any highlights or points you want to make sure the board understands prior to a vote?
Sure. I just wanted to go over, do an overview of the 2022-2023 undergraduate program and what the program structure was like. So the key statistics, there were 183 eligible applications, students that qualified. Of that 183, we will be awarding 171, and that is a total funding of $489,000. The program structure did not change much from the previous years. The application was made available on the Cheslow website on March 1st. We notified high school counselors and financial aid officers and the State Department of Education when it was available. An announcement was also made on the Cheslow, on all of Cheslow's social media outlets. The deadline was May 1st, giving the students 2 months to apply and submit all of their documents to Foundit. And the Cheslow staff communicated with those students within those 2 months about documents, missing documents, or incorrect documents uploaded to make sure they met that deadline. The scholarship committee, as always, consisted of four people: Jeanette, Josh, and Shannon, and myself. The scholarship committee reviewed all of the qualified applications individually and scored them. Then the applicant scoring totals of all the committee members were sorted for a consensus ranking list. The scholarship committee met to discuss all of the recipients, and that's when we decided on the 171 recipients. The eligibility requirements also stayed the same as previous years. There were six requirements. The award amounts also remained the same, $3,000 for full-time students and $1,500 for half-time. And we will be informing those students of their award in July and disperse in September after we verify the student's enrollment. Now Josh will present the scholarship data analysis.
Yeah, thanks. I just wanted to briefly touch on the scholarship data analysis. So on, on page 171 is Exhibit A. Exhibits A and B included in your package include a data breakdown of all the qualified applications received. The data includes race, gender, age group, grade classification, institution attending, hometown and attendance status. Exhibit C and D. Exhibit C is on page 173. They include the same data for just the recipients. So in terms of the applicants, the data shows a broad distribution across much of the state with 76 towns represented. The applicants will be attending 24 of the state's 34 public or nonprofit universities, and the applicant pool was racially diverse, although the majority of the applicants were female, and that's been a trend that's continued from past years. I know Marty asked that.
Yeah, Josh, why is it 75% of the applicants and grantees are women? I know this helps deal with the problem that Dr. Cannaval talked about, but the Sacred Heart get any of the scholarships? Maybe Julie can give some insight as to why this is dominantly a female scholarship.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if Julie has any thoughts, but I'm, at least from my knowledge, I think in terms of students attending higher education as a whole, I think there's more female students in higher education in general. But Julie, I don't know if you have any thoughts on what Sacred Heart has seen.
Well, you know, Josh, you're right. And in higher ed, it is, you know, females, you know, it can be at most of our institutions almost a 60-40 or a 70-30 split. I'm not so sure. Yeah, I'm not so sure what it is on the public school level, but I would suspect that it probably is. And, you know, quite often, you know, they're just going to apply for the scholarships, you know, scholarship searching and whatnot. Oftentimes is, you know, the females will dominate that kind of effort, I think.
Well, good, I guess.
I wanted to add that I've noticed with our certificate program this year, we did get to award all $30,000. And you'll notice, if looking at those stats, that it's mostly male applicants for certificates. So right. I think a lot of the males are going into trades, where females are going into getting their degrees. An observation.
Very helpful. Very helpful. Thank you.
Yeah, and just a couple more points. I know we want to wrap this up. So basically, the recipients, the data trends, you know, very similarly to the applicants we received. The awardees represent 74 towns and 23 institutions. And just lastly, as a reminder, the scholarship application for the healthcare and manufacturing certificates will open on July 1st. At the January board meeting, the board approved an allocation of $30,000 for that program. And as Yesenia mentioned, in this current fiscal year, we were able to award all of those certificate scholarships totaling the $30,000. And I think that was the first year ever we awarded all the certificate scholarships. And we hope that continues in the next application period.
Josh, could you have used more money there, or was $30,000 enough to deal with all of the qualified applicants?
I think $30,000 was enough. I think the last certificate disbursement was in May, so towards the end of our fiscal year. We'll keep an eye on it. You know, if we go through the $30,000 pretty quickly this year, we can always reevaluate the undergrad versus certificate allocation for future years.
I'm a great fan of certificates, so I would be in favor of increasing that amount if you thought you could use it.
Okay. Yeah, like I said, I think because this current fiscal year, that was the first year we utilized all the certificate scholarships. I think we just want to see another year's worth of data and then reevaluate that for future years.
Thank you.
Thank you. So that's it for the scholarship. Are there any further questions?
Just need a vote.
That's right.
Oh yeah, exactly.
And the motion's been made and seconded. Any further questions or discussion? Anyone? Well, thank you, Josh and Yesenia. All those in favor of the scholarship memo and approval is presented in the board packet, please say aye.
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 Is there anyone opposed? Are there any abstentions? Thank you very much. Motion carries unanimously. And Josh and Yesenia, thank you again for your work on this. It's a wonderful program.
Thank you.
All right. Next item, the financial report. Carly.
Thank you very much. I'm going to start on page 178 in the board packet, and I just want to make note of a couple corrections on the header for under quarter to date and actually year to date as well. It says actual 2002. That should be 2022. So the error carries through on the next three pages as well. So that's one quick little note. And then also on page 178 under the quarter to date budget column, my formula was incorrect. I have corrected it since. So I just want to give you the updated numbers under the budget for the in-school product. The budgeted amount should have been 22,628, not 74,200. And the refinance should have been $13,224, not $4,408. So if we go down to the line total operation and non-operating income and loss, that amount should be a positive 67,507, not the negative 89,000. So I just want to make that quick little note. So staying on page 178 for the 9 months ending March 31st, 2022, revenues over expenses before non-operating income and expenses were $81,430. And revenues over expenses after non-operating income and expenses were $83,401. Total year-to-date revenues were $40,846 under budget. And total year-to-date expenses were $49,005 under budget. Questions regarding the income statement for the agency? Let's see. So we'll go to page 183. And we'll look at the two bond resolutions. So again, this is for March 31st. And the total change in net position for the 1990 resolution is a decrease of $217,984, which is due to the decline in the market value for the T-notes, which were in both the 2020 C scarf and the 2020 D scarf. Total change in net position for the 2019 resolution is a decrease of $136,494, which is due primarily to the increase in the allowance for loan loss. And then also there was an unrealized loss in the 2021 B loan fund, which was an error that I contacted U.S. Bank regarding. And I was told that there was a system error when they entered a sale on the investment in the loan fund. They corrected it. It was fixed on April 19th, and I have verified that that is has been corrected. Questions for the two bond funds? If not, we can move on to page 186, and I'll just quickly go over the other programs. So our first one is our scholarship fund. So the total change in that position for this quarter was a decrease of $15,237. And like Josh had mentioned in his report that the we used additional scholarship dispersed additional scholarships with use of funds that were returned and then also interest earned on the investments. And total change in net position for the non-bond refi program was an increase of $913,947. And that increase is due to the $1 million contribution that was received from CSLF. And the last thing, other questions? I just had one more item I needed to mention quickly. And that is regarding the write-offs that we are going to be doing for fiscal 2022 with our collection agency. So the amount of in-school student loans to be written off for this fiscal year are $652,911, which is slightly higher than last year's write-offs of $635,000. And we do not have any refi loans that we are going to be writing off in this fiscal year. Recoveries are slightly down from last year. As of March 31st, our recoveries are about 31,000. And last year, the recoveries were 77,000 up to this point. So we are more than 50% less in our recoveries. Any questions? That is all I have for the financial report then.
Oh, I had a question on page 187. Sure. 187, the next page. It appears the investments on the 1990 resolutions, there's a GIC and there are some treasury bonds. I take it those come over to the new resolution as a result of the refunding of the 1990 resolution. So those investments are now in the 2019 resolution. Is that correct?
Go ahead.
Thank you. So the treasuries were sold so that they could be invested in securities that properly matched the redemption requirements of the refunded bonds. And the GICs were in the Special Capital Reserve Fund, and those did transfer over.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Carly? Anything? Carly, I'll just say that I appreciate your candor at the outset, where you cited some mistakes in your formulas. Speaking for myself, I'm not sure I would have caught those mistakes. Maybe some other board members would have, but I appreciate your candor in putting it right out there for us. So thank you. Thank you for your work on this.
Thank you.
Okay, we've got a couple updates, starting with the authority update. Jeanette?
Yeah, so I don't have anything additional for authority updates, but Josh will be providing the portfolio highlights, and also in Shannon's absence, he will be providing the marketing update.
Okay. All right, over to you, Josh.
Okay, thank you both. So I'm going to start on page 191 of the package. Chesil has dispersed $15.8 million through the third quarter of fiscal 22. That includes $8 million of disbursements in the third quarter. The loan volume through quarter three represents a 10% decline compared to fiscal 21 through the third quarter. As we mentioned, previously, we'll be budgeting this year an increase to for loan disbursements to hopefully get back to the $18.1 million that we saw in fiscal 21. Moving on to page 193. The market segment data for the schools, status quo at the top was Sacred Heart, UConn, and Quinnipiac. I just also wanted to point out for your reference there in the purple, I just have a comparison for the top schools, their loan volume compared to the same point through quarter three of fiscal 21. And you can see it really varies across the board by institution. Moving to page 194, this is the 21B comparison to the cash flow assumptions. It does not look great. We're $3.8 million behind the assumed cash flows. I would just point out that there's no debt service issues. As you know, we just completed our 2022 bond deal, and cash flows were obviously run for that bond deal, and there's no debt service issues at all. Moving on to page 195, we're at the refi seat loan disbursement data. The refinance program has rebounded nicely in the third quarter, dispersing almost $1.1 million. We've dispersed almost $2 million total in fiscal 22 through the third quarter, which represents a $1 million increase, or a 94% increase from fiscal 21 through the third quarter. So those are the key highlights. I know we have a lot on the agenda, so just really wanted to point out those pieces. Are there any questions regarding what I just presented or on any of my reports in the package?
Any questions for Josh? No, I guess not. Thank you, Josh.
And then I think, Peter, I can just go right into...
Move right into the marketing update.
Marketing update. So just wanted to point out two things. First, on page 203, I think this is pretty important. More people know about our financial literacy portal, CT Dollars and Cents. Over 75% of online traffic visits are directly to the site. And that represents a 20% increase from the year prior. So we're happy to see that the portal is getting recognized and people are continuing to visit the information there. On page 204, just the point to make, we saw over a 15% increase of online traffic visits to Chesla coming from referrals. And referrals typically can be translated to marketing. Or somebody that has had a previous Chesla loan and then recommended that to another family. So those are the key points from marketing. Any questions there?
Anyone? Okay, well done, Josh. And right, your thanks. Team. Thank you. Okay, prior to the board meeting, the Audit Finance Committee met, chaired by Marty Budd. Marty, would you like to give a synopsis of the actions there?
Thank you. You have materials that were sent out that show the budget, which the committee is recommending to the board for approval. I'll highlight three or four things. There was an overall increase in the budget on operating expenses. Most of these were an additional $40,000 for marketing, which we thought showed promise. And we'll see whether the additional marketing expenditures actually provide a greater loan origination. And that'll be tracked. And the other large increase in expenses were employee benefits, mostly in the insurance area. So there was an overall increase in operating expenses of 5%. But fortunately, there was an even greater increase in revenue. One is the income from investments, which, as you all know, interest rates are going up, so it looks like we'll make more money on our cash that we hold, and also for increased fees that are provided in debtors. So the budget shows a excess revenue of $427,000. Which is significantly more than the excess revenue this year. So with all that good news, obviously, it was easy to recommend approval of the budget to this, to board. That's it.
So the budget was unanimously approved by the Audit Finance Committee, and now it's being brought to the full board for its approval. So I would be happy to entertain a motion to accept the Audit Finance Committee's recommendation to approve the budget. And then if there are questions, we can open up to discussion. So first things first, is there a motion to accept the Audit Finance Committee's recommendation
on
the
fiscal 20?
Thank you, Marty. Is there a second?
Julie Savino, second.
All right, the motion is made and seconded to accept the Audit Finance Committee's recommendation on the fiscal 23 operating budget. Are there any questions, items for discussion? Questions? Hearing none, all those in favor of accepting the Audit Finance Committee's recommendation and adopting the fiscal 23 operating budget, please say aye.
Aye.
Is there anyone opposed? Any abstentions? Motion carries unanimously. Thank you. Thank you, Marty. Denise, are you going to walk us through the money purchase pension plan amendment?
Yes. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, great. So CHESLA is a participating employer in CHIFA's money purchase plan. And in 2019, CHIFA amended and restated the plan utilizing an IRS pre-approved plan document. A pre-approved plan document is essentially a boilerplate retirement plan document that incorporates all the provisions required by federal law. And vendors of these pre-approved plans are required to update and submit these plans to the IRS every 6 years to bring the plans up to date with federal law. In accordance with IRS guidelines, an employer that uses a pre-approved plan must adopt a new plan by July 31, 2022. Plan provisions that are specific to CHIFA's plan are made in the adoption agreement that corresponds to the pre-approved plan. For example, CHIFA and CHESLA's vesting formula, vesting schedule, employee eligibility criteria, and contribution formula are all set forth in the adoption agreement, starting at page 261 of the board package. There are no changes to CHIFA's specific plan provisions. One notable change in the plan document is that it provides for a standalone trust as currently required by the IRS, whereas the current plan document includes a trust within the document. After their meeting this week, the CHIFA board approved the amended and restated plan and the corresponding adoption agreement. And CHESLA, as a participating employer, must also approve the plan and corresponding participation agreement, which is on page 283 of the board package. So staff recommends approval of the two documents. And on page 207 of the board package is a resolution for approval of the documents. I'd be happy to answer any questions the board has.
Are there any questions? Hearing none, I would entertain a motion to adopt the amendment and participation agreement as presented in the board packet. Is there a motion? I'll be happy to move it. Is there a second?
I'll second it.
Motion's been made and seconded to adopt the money purchase pension plan amendment and participation agreement as presented in the board packet. Are there any questions, comments?
I think it's worth, I was unaware of this plan altogether until this issue. And maybe we could just have a brief explanation of how the plan works. We have three employees that participate and what the nature of the contributions are and when people get their payments out.
Okay.
Sure, Marty. So in order to be eligible to participate in the plan, you have to complete 3 months of service. The employer contribution is 10%. And the vesting schedule is you have to be employed for 4 years. You cannot remove anything from the plan while you're employed. You have to wait till you're terminated from employment. And the CHIFA in 2019, CHESLA also did approve the amended plan, Marty, and the participation agreement. So whenever there is a new pre-approved plan adopted, the participating employer also has to approve it. So CHESLA did approve it back in 2019.
Can you explain how the money is invested while the employee continues to work?
Sure. We contract with the principal. They are a record keeper, and we have a group annuity contract with them. So all of the plan investments are held through that annuity contract, and the participants can direct the investment of their account among various investment alternatives, including target funds.
And we work with a unit of RBC as our advisors with regard to the investments. So they do regular, you know, monitoring of the performance of the options that are offered to employees. So there's basically a menu of available, you know, funds that, and from those funds, staff get to choose which ones, where they want to put their money. And so there's annual staff education on, you know, the use of, you know, retirement savings, et cetera, overview of the performance of the various funds that are available. And then the chief officers serve as trustees.
Thank you very much. Very helpful.
Okay. Any other questions? All right, the motion's been made and seconded. Unless there's further discussion or questions, I'd call for a vote. All those in favor of adopting the Money Purchase Pension Plan Amendment and Participation Agreement as found in the board packet, please say aye.
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 Is there anyone opposed? Are there any abstentions? Thank you. Motion carries unanimously. Thank you. The next item of business, I would like to move, make a motion to move into executive session to discuss the executive director's performance evaluation. Would someone like to second that?
Second.
All right. All those in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Aye. All right. I'd like to move into executive session and ask the executive director to stay with the meeting, please. And you should have something on your screen that says join the breakout room. Okay, we are back, and I'll just state for the record, in executive session, there were no votes taken. And our next item of business is if anyone has any new business or any other business to bring before the board.
I have two quick things. When, Jeanette, are we going to get a report on the arbitrage rebate and whether we have violated any laws or where we are?
So if you recall, Marty, with the change, with the resignation of our prior consultant and our hiring of BLX, there was no further audit that was involved because at that point we had changed firms, but we will certainly, you know, make further reports with regard to the next issue is the loan yield mitigation efforts that we'll put forth with regard to the series of bonds that has a liability. So that will be coming in the fall.
All right. And the other report I'm looking forward to, which we ought to put on the agenda and maybe make note in the minutes, A, they were going to get the arbitrage report that you're talking about. But the other one is the economic effect of what we're doing. We hired a consultant. We're going to have a report, I assume, as you previously mentioned to me in the fall about the impact of Chesla. So those are two things that ought to be in the minutes just to remind us that we're going to get them in the fall.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Marty. Anything else? Any other items for the good of the cause? All right, hearing none, I'd entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second? I will second it. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Thank you very much. The meeting's adjourned.